Well, it is great to be back here with you. I was here this morning, and I was also here a year ago, and or a couple of years ago, I think, actually. And I suddenly realized that the subject matter that I had agreed to speak on this evening is something that I actually spoke about 2 years ago while I was here, where I was quoting, amongst other things, Jane Austen and the Black Eyed Peas and so on. And then I said, well, wait a minute, I've now got the same title again, so you want to give the same talk. And your church leader said, yes, please go ahead, do exactly the same talk, because everyone would have forgotten what you said. No one remembers. So for the second time of asking, we will be looking at this issue of God of love, God of judgment. And I guess that the question that we'll be asking this evening is a very, very important one, because it goes very much to the character and the nature of God. And if I were to rephrase the question slightly, I guess I'd put it this way. And it goes something like this. Well, look, if the Christian faith and the Christian God is at heart such a loving, kind, merciful being, why is it that in the Bible there's an awful lot of talk about God's judgment, God's justice? Why is it at times that it seems to be incredibly intolerant? And surely these two things aren't compatible. If it's the case that there is a God who is loving, kind, merciful, then surely everything should be accepted. And he just welcomes everyone regardless of where they're coming from, where they are. On the other hand, then how then do we square this? And is it the case that therefore actually the God that Christians worship is maybe even slightly schizophrenic? Sometimes, you know, he's got sort of this nice, light, fluffy, cuddly kind of God, and then other days he has a bad hair day, and all of a sudden that's when you get a God who is much less attractive to the modern mind. So I'm going to be phrasing quite a few questions, and I'm going to be making you think. I hope that's okay. I'm going to be asking you some difficult questions. Payback is that you are allowed to ask me questions, and I think when I finish speaking, there should be a text number, which there is up there, and you can actually, while I'm talking, text in your question, and then at the end, we'll see how many of those questions that we can actually answer, and then there'll be another time of worship and prayer, just to let you know where we're going. So do feel free to text in a question if you have one. Now, a couple of years ago, I got a letter from the Home Office, and on the bottom was printed their logo and also a strap line. The strap line read this: creating a free, just, and tolerant society. Creating a free, just, and tolerant society. And I guess where I'd like to start is by raising the question about whether maybe it's only possible for only two of those three things to actually exist. Now, we live in a society where we talk about tolerance very much as a positive virtue. However, in our common everyday language, we define it negatively. I had lunch today. I was entertained by one of the leaders here and his wife, Charlie, and she cooked for me. So let's supposing at the end of this service, you come and say, oh, Michael, I understand that the church put on a meal for you, someone cooked for you in their home. Was the food okay? And I say, yes, it was tolerable. And let's imagine Charlie is standing behind me and she hears me express this. Now, is she likely to be thinking, as I say, yes, I could tolerate the food, that will she be thinking, gosh, next time Michael's in town, I must have him round to my house and cook another meal for him? Just before speaking to you this evening, I was with a couple of gentlemen and we were talking about various things, and let's suppose you came up to me at the end of the service and you said, Michael, did you enjoy talking with them? And I said, yes, I could tolerate their company. And let's supposing they were to overhear me saying that to you. Do you think that they'll be sitting here going, well, gosh, you know, the next time Michael's around, I'm going to look him up and spend some more time with him? Isn't it interesting how we talk an awful lot about tolerance, and yet I don't know anyone who wants to be tolerated? In almost every discipline, by every definition that we have in our dictionary, tolerance is a negative. It's defined negatively. In engineering terms, tolerance is the amount of error, if you like, that can be built within the system, within which, plus or minus, eventually the whole thing will collapse. Your body becomes tolerant against disease when you've built enough antibodies to be able to fight it off. Okay? When we talk about being able to tolerate people's company and so on, these words are used negatively. And yet, most people, even though that is the way that it is defined in terms of our modern dictionary, and I want to look at this in a different way in a minute, we still think of it as a positive quality. Now, what I would like to suggest to you is that it is entirely possible that tolerance, if that is how we are to understand it, becomes the enemy both of freedom and of justice. If I were to say, look, I am prepared to tolerate you, what I'm basically saying is, look, I think that you are completely in error. Okay? What you're saying or the way you're behaving is completely wrong. And you're either too stupid or too stubborn to recognize that fact. However, I am kind, gracious, and merciful. And because I am so far superior to you in character in every way, I am prepared to put up with you. When I say I am prepared to tolerate you, I am saying something which is to your detriment, okay? And I'm claiming something which is better for me. Now, however, if I were to say I respect you, now I'm saying something very, very different. When I say I respect you, what I'm now saying is there is something within you that demands I treat you in a certain way. And it's got nothing to do about how wonderful I am. It's got everything to do with the fact about who you are and the fact that you're a human being that demands that I treat you in a certain way. Now, here's the key thing. You cannot tolerate someone and disagree with someone, but you can respect someone and disagree with someone. You see, as soon as you disagree with someone, you cease to be tolerant of their position. But therefore, in a free society, and in a society where we talk about justice, is tolerance, as it is negatively understood, is it a virtue or is it a vice? Is it possible to live in a free society where tolerance, which seems to silence all forms of debate, is that the best way forward? Or would we much rather live in a society where we learn to treat each other with respect, where we treat individuals with respect, where we recognize that there is something special about them? Because I say you can respect people and disagree with them, but to tolerate someone and disagree with them is impossible. Now, there is a way of doing this which is rhetorically opposite to what I've been doing, although conceptually the same. So let me now just put that on hold. We're now going to step back into a time warp. We're going to go back to the Middle Ages. In the Middle Ages, the church doctrine that was evolved of tolerare malus did go the other way, where it was a very much a positive virtue, but not in the way that we would think of it in terms of modern language. For the Middle Ages, this doctrine basically taught that I should not only defend your right to disagree with me, but that if you wanted to live a lifestyle that went against what I believe to be right and true, that I should be able and be prepared to lay down my life to defend your right to do it. Are you with me? Tolerare malus said that not only should I defend your right to be able to disagree with me, I should defend your right so that if people come after to persecute you because of something which you're doing, which I think is actually wrong, that I will also defend those people against doing something which would not be respectful of who you are as a person. In that sense, the traditional doctrine of tolerare malus is what we understand in the contemporary language of respect. Now, as I say, these are two different ways of doing it, but we need to go, I would say, one of two ways. Either we need to wind back the clock and get a proper understanding of what tolerance is as a positive force, or we need to abandon that language altogether and reframe a lot of this in terms of respect. Now, let's then just spin this out into justice, because I said not only do I think that this is actually goes against the idea of freedom, I also think it goes against justice. By definition, when you tolerate someone, you are saying that you disagree with them. You are saying that what they are doing or thinking is wrong. However, when you ask for justice, what you are saying is that which is right should be enforced. Are you with me, or is this too complicated this time of evening? If you listen to this talk again with a large glass of wine, it'll probably make a lot more sense. When we talk about justice and building a just society, we're not talking about tolerating evil or any kind of wrongdoing. We're actually talking about enforcing that which is right. What is the kind of society we wish to live in? Is it possible that we have tripped up ourselves on our language by not thinking these things through clearly enough? Which is why we feel so conflicted between wanting to disagree with some things and say that they're wrong, while campaigning at other times for things which we believe are right and telling other people that what they're doing is wrong, they have to stop doing. If you are still not sure about this, find anyone who feels passionate about the environment, who also believes in tolerance, and ask if we should tolerate drivers of Range Rovers. And if you are a driver of a Range Rover, then let me say that I'd like to have a ride home with you. Now, having laid some groundwork here, I'd like to just come back to the main question, which I started by raising with you, which is, why is it that this God of love that the Bible talks about also seems to be a God of judgment. Is it the case that these two things run against each other? And here again, I'll just like to try to broaden your horizons a little bit. And please forgive me if you're familiar with what I'm about to say here. When we talk about love and judgment, we're not often playing two things against each other. And I'd like to suggest to you that that is maybe not possible. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Jane Austen's book, Pride and Prejudice. Have some of you read it? It's a fantastic book. Many would say one of the most famous love stories written in the English language. You may have seen the 6-part BBC adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. If you've seen that, just put up your hand. If you've seen the 6-part BBC adaptation. Okay, that's most of the women in the room. Men, if you're sitting here tonight and you're single, then that's probably the reason why. Now, if you have seen that BBC adaptation, you will immediately recognize both the story and the striking resemblance between myself and Mr. Darcy. But if you're unfamiliar, let me just give you a recap. Pride and Prejudice is a love story at its essence, at its heart. Two main characters, a wonderful woman called Elizabeth and a man called Mr. Darcy. Now, to cut a long story short, Mr. Darcy falls in love with Elizabeth, but he doesn't quite realize it. And he's slightly awkward around her. There are some misunderstandings. And then, of course, there comes a time where he suddenly becomes more aware of his feelings. And he's walking up to her home in order to actually speak to some members of the family. And he walks into their cottage, steps into the front room where Elizabeth is alone. He now finds himself alone with a woman, unchaperoned. As a gentleman, protocol dictates that he leaves. He cannot remain alone in a room with a woman without a chaperone present. So he turns on his heel and says, "I'm very sorry, I did not realize you were on your own," and makes to leave. And as he's leaving, he stops halfway through the door. He turns around, he walks back into the room, he looks at her and he says, "It will not do. My feelings cannot be repressed any longer. You must allow me to tell you how much I ardently admire and love you." Now, gentlemen, listen carefully. That line is a winner. However, he then goes on to say that he loves her, even though it goes against his will, against his reason, and against his better character. She then rejects this declaration of love. Being a man, he cannot understand why. So he asks for explanation. And she says, "I would have found it easier to reject your offer, harder to reject your declaration of love if you'd acted in a more gentlemanlike manner. You told me that you loved me, even though it went against your reason, against your character, against your own better judgment." Against your own better character. In other words, she's saying, "You told me you loved me, even though it went against all better judgment." It's very interesting. We live in a world where we're desperate for intimacy. We're so desperate for intimacy and for meaningful friendship that most of us go around projecting an image of ourselves to other people, hoping that they will like us. The tragedy is that people then fall in love with the image and they never encounter the reality. This is why the very rich, the very powerful, the very famous, very beautiful, at times find it hard to find true love. Because we do not know whether those who profess friendship truly like us or the image which is around us. True love does not exist in the absence of judgment. True love only exists in the presence of it. Have you ever known a love like that? If there are a group of people in this world who are around you, who like you, who think you're a wonderful, who are so kind to you, but they don't know the real you. They don't know your weaknesses, your failings, your shortcomings. They don't know the dark side of your character at all. If you're surrounded by people like that, I don't care how popular you are, I can also promise you, you are desperately lonely. However, if there are a group of people in this world who do love you and know your weaknesses, your failings, your shortcomings, that darker side to you, Those are the most meaningful friendships you have. And when anything bad happens, and even more interestingly, when anything great happens, they are the first people you want to tell. True love does not exist in the absence of judgment. True love only exists in the presence of it. It is only in the presence of true moral judgment about our character that we actually truly find out who our friends are and who truly loves us. And that is precisely the way in which God loves us. Again, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the work of the contemporary philosophers, the Black Eyed Peas. I have read most of their treatises and listened to them regularly. Let me just quote to you some words from one of their songs. This is called "Where Is the Love?" First published, I think, about 10 years ago, roughly. Number one. People killing, people dying, children hurt, you hear them crying. Now you know why there aren't any English rappers. Can you practice what you preach? Would you turn the other cheek? Father, 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 help us. Send us from guidance from above, because people have me questioning, where is the love? I feel the weight of the world on my shoulders. As I get older, people get colder. Most of us only care about money-making. Selfishness got us following the wrong direction. Wrong information always shown on the media. Negative images are the main criteria. Although, to be fair to their song, it says negative images is the main criteria, but I've corrected the grammar because it's not right. Infecting young minds faster than bacteria. Kids want to act like they see in the cinema. Whatever happened to the values of humanity? Whatever happened to fairness and equality? Instead of spreading love, we spread animosity, lack of understanding leading lives away from unity. Now, here's the key insight. The truth is kept secret. It's swept under the rug. If you've never known truth, then you've never known love. I don't know if they wrote this themselves or someone wrote it for them. But whoever wrote this knows exactly what they're talking about. The truth is kept secret. It's swept under the rug. If you've never known truth, then you've never known love. True love does not exist in the absence of judgment. True love only exists in the presence of it. You cannot pit God's love and judgment against each other. What makes love meaningful is when the person who speaks those words, "I love you, I care for you, I am close to you, you are my friend," knows the real you. They have a proper moral judgment of who you are, not a false one. Which is why these two qualities are not at war within God's character, and which is why we read of God's love and judgment in both the Old Testament and our Old Testament and the New Testament. Now, we live in a morally conditioned universe. All relationships are morally conditioned. You only have to think about this for a moment. Hey, your friends, your family, your spouse, your work colleagues, those with whom you enjoy working, those whom you enjoy fellowship, those who you are close to, all of those relationships are morally governed. If you meet someone who you feel you could never trust, it's not the fact that you may never work with them, you may have to, but you can never give yourself to them. And because we live in a world that's morally governed and morally regulated, you will adjust your behavior properly to make sure that they neither take advantage of you nor stab you in the back. We live in a morally conditioned universe, and all relationships are morally governed, which is why we have a sense of injustice when our friends betray us, and a sense of justice being fulfilled in genuine intimate relationship when we actually find people who are loyal, who are committed. Now, we live in a world where we increasingly talk about justice, and where we increasingly talk about injustice, where we increasingly invoke moral categories all of the time to say what so-and-so does is wrong, this war is wrong, this action is wrong, this behavior is wrong, you're being selfish, this is narcissism. We use these words in our culture all of the time. We are consistently making moral judgments, but the question is, where do these moral values come from? And whose are they? We may be terrified about the idea of living in a world where God's moral justice is upheld, but it will be impossible to live in a world where there was no moral justice at all. It's very interesting. The word compassion comes from the ecclesiastical Latin. It's an ancient word that the church invented or brought into the Latin, what's called the ecclesiastical law of the church, to help with its ecclesiastical courts. I can see you're all riveted by this piece of information. It basically means, it's a compound word, and it has a rich meaning, and it basically means, to act with compassion means to make a moral judgment about a situation and be moved in the depth of your being to do something about it. So you have compassion in the face of slavery. When you say, that is wrong, you make an absolute moral judgment, and you're moved in the depth of your being to do something about it. Now, if you're not moved in your being to do something about it, you don't have compassion, you have moralizing. You are moved with compassion in the face of racism when you make an absolute moral judgment. You say, that is wrong. Shouldn't be like that. But you're not just happy to moralize about it. You are moved to the depth of your being to do something about it, to act on it. If you don't act on it, you don't have compassion. You just have moralizing again. Is it possible that we live in an increasingly compassionless society because we seem to be scared of making moral judgments about anything anymore? And so relationships have become shallow. Our compassion has become shallow. We're not moved by a sense of justice. This is wrong. We should do something about it. We're moved by sympathy or by guilt. I should be doing something about it. So here's £10 to make myself feel better. I'll send someone else to do it. The God who's revealed in the Bible is a God who's revealed as being gracious and compassionate. God is compassionate because he makes a moral judgment about every human heart. He sees what's wrong. And he says, what I see in this heart is wrong. But then he's also moved to do something about it. And that is the cross. God does pass judgment on every human heart. He does see where we're wrong. He does see where we're failing. But he is moved to the depth of his being to do something about it. The Christian gospel is that God himself has broken through into this world. He has come. And he has given himself to make it possible for us to know him, to have relationship with him. So let me just say a few words about this as well. Because if you were to Google Richard Dawkins, The Times, earthquake, you will find a very powerfully written editorial in which Richard Dawkins rants and raves quite literally about the fact that the entire Christian faith, indeed the entire biblical system, is one morally grotesque system of sacrifice where God pays us back for sin and then in the worst possible act that you could possibly imagine sacrifices his own son in order to be able to forgive. And he says this is morally outrageous. And I can sort of understand what he says. Let's suppose you were to offend me in some way. And afterwards you come up and you say, Michael, I'm sorry about that. Will you please forgive me? And I say, yes, I do want to forgive you. But before I can forgive you, I must first sacrifice my little son, James. And when I have sacrificed him, I'm in a position to forgive you. I mean, you'd think there'd be something wrong with me if I did that, right? I'm hoping you would think there was something wrong with me if I did that. But is this what is at the heart of the gospel? Now, we all talk about mercy. But again, mercy is another one of those words that we talk a lot, but we don't think about that frequently. Mercy, again, by definition, always comes at the expense of justice. Just think about it. If someone extends mercy to you, once again, it's because, well, you did something that was wrong in some way. And instead of giving you justice, giving you what you deserve, they give you mercy. They forgive you, right? Otherwise, it wouldn't be mercy. If they gave you justice, then you'd be getting justice. You're getting what you do deserve. So you always exercise mercy at the expense of justice. You're saying, well, look, you did this, and really, I should... You know, you should be punished in some way, or we're going to duck your pocket money if it's your child or something like that. But instead of doing that, you say, but you know what? I'm going to let it go. I forgive you. In that sense, mercy, by definition, is always exercised at the expense of justice. Now, here's the question. For God, how does God exercise mercy at the expense of his justice? How can God be just and morally perfect and also at the same time be merciful? And not extend mercy at the expense of his justice. How is that possible? And the answer is that although in every other religion God does exercise his mercy at the expense of his justice, at the cross God exercises his mercy through his justice. It's through the justice of the cross where God himself comes into this world and he pays the price for what we have done wrong. He takes the judgment for what we have done wrong. He fulfills the requirements of the law. He fulfills all of that. He pays that justice is upheld and mercy is extended through it. Have you ever received that kind of mercy? Now, this may still seem like an extreme reaction. And it is an extreme reaction if it is the case that actually, if it is the case that sin, what we do wrong, isn't really that serious. I mean, for example, is this like, you know, a little child takes an extra biscuit from a biscuit jar? If you're American, that's a cookie from a cookie jar. Okay? But we're praying for healing, that you'll learn to speak English as God intended originally. And then God massively overreacts. Well, that was wrong. Okay, cross. I was at an event 3 days ago with Richard Dawkins, and someone was making a very general point, and at one point he leant over to the woman speaking next to him who runs the Richard Dawkins Foundation and said, and that's why we need the cross. Jesus has to die for us. And we hadn't even got to the subject of forgiveness or mercy. Is that what it's like? A couple of weeks ago I was speaking down in London, and just before I spoke there was a live link to a boat with five women on it, and they were rowing across the Atlantic. Now, there was this boat race started a couple of months ago, women in boats, six people in a boat rowing across the Atlantic. Okay? If you're thinking of doing this, you may need a full-scale psychiatric evaluation. But these women had put themselves in training, and they were racing across the Atlantic. Now, there was one boat where one of the crew of six was a member of this particular church. And so she got her church and all of her friends and all the other people on this boat to get sponsorship for their boat, for the boat race, to raise money against the trafficking of sex slaves. Now, it seems strange in the 21st century to be talking about slavery, but more people are being bought and sold as slaves right now than when we so-called abolished slavery. As a matter of fact, who would have thought that the British media, the British news, could run an expose of women being flown into British airports, having their passports taken for them, sold as cattle to producers of pornography and various pimps, and then trafficked straight through either into the UK or into the rest of Europe at the rates of tens of thousands a year? It's unbelievable. But we are buying and selling more slaves now than we were historically. Millions and millions, if the estimates are to be believed. And so she was raising money from this crew. And this particular crew, they set off 2 days late because one of the six girls at the last minute dropped out. So now they're a crew of five. And for 2 days, they looked for a sixth crew member. They couldn't find one. And then they set off in the boat anyway, just the five of them. Okay, which meant that I guess they were all doing 1/6 more rowing or whatever it was, and therefore having sleep shorter breaks. And in the process, broke two world records. Now, they finished fifth overall, but that's not important because they started 2 days late. They set a new speed record for crossing the Atlantic and obviously a new record for being a five-person crew as opposed to a six-person crew. And when we went live to this boat, which was being tossed around in the Atlantic by these huge waves, and the connection was pretty poor, as you can imagine, and they were squashed into this tiny living space, and when they then announced about the amount of money they had raised to fight against rescuing women who'd been sold into slavery, the whole auditorium burst out into applause and started clapping. And it's an inspirational thing. Now, what's gone wrong in that scenario? Why is it so serious? The reason is that these women that they're raising money for to be rescued are not being treated as people, they're being treated as objects. Now, one of the cries of the feminist movement back in the 70s and 80s was a cry to say, look, we are not objects to be ogled at and bought and sold. We are people. Please treat us as people. As women, we are people. Relate to us as people. Which is why you could have Billy Graham and also some of the key leaders of the feminist movement publicly protesting against prostitution and pornography together, even though they came from completely different ideological convictions, because they were united in the grounds that people should not be treated as objects, we should relate to them as people. Now, however, we have a completely liberated society. It's very interesting. But what all the new feminists are saying is this. Back in the 80s, when we were campaigning for this, we wanted to be treated like men. We're saying, treat us like people. We are human beings, just like everybody else. Treat me like a human being. But where we've ended up is now everybody seems happy to treat themselves as an object. So we talk of marketing ourselves, of promoting ourselves. In the hippie revolution of the 60s, when people had sex with each other, and obviously there was a lot of promiscuity going around, the idea was very much built around the idea of making a mystical connection, connecting with people, having intimacy somehow. Whereas now we don't talk about sex in that way, we talk about it in purely physical terms. It's not about connection anymore, it's about consumption. But people are not objects to be consumed. But as soon as we make people objects in that sense, that's precisely what happens. They become objects to be consumed. The reason why God takes a strong view about sin is it dehumanizes us. It not only means that we start treating other people as objects, it dehumanizes us inside. We become less capable of relating to other people with genuine feelings of intimacy. It diminishes our capacity for relationship. And if our goal is to have relationship with God and relationship with each other, and sin at its core destroys relationship with God and destroys our capacity to have a relationship with other people, then this is very, very serious. Which is why we, if we are suffering injustice, we sing at the prospect of it. I don't know if you've ever suffered gross injustice, but if you have, I can promise you that you have longed for justice. I don't know if anyone's ever stolen something valuable from you, or wronged you in a major way, or maybe abused you in some way. If you are caught up in that kind of situation where you have experienced that, you long for justice, you cry for justice, we look for justice. Now, if we're on the other side, we're not so interested. Imagine at the end of this meeting you were to leave. Let's suppose you've managed to park your car out the back of the church. And you walk out of the meeting and you're thinking to yourself, what was that man trying to say? And the friend who brought you here this evening, who promised you it would be interesting, and obviously that didn't happen, is trying to explain to you. And you walk up to your car, you're about to put the key in, and you step back and someone has keyed your car. Someone has taken their key and walked all the way up the length of it and scratched it all the way up and back again. Now, how would you feel? You don't believe in God. You're an atheist. Wouldn't you feel like looking up to God, up to heaven and saying, God, is this some kind of idea of a sick joke? I come to church. I don't believe in you. I hear some guy ranting and raving at the front. And then I come out and now look what's happened. I mean, isn't that how you would feel? And you also feel a bit hopeless about it, right? Okay. I mean, what are you going to do? Rig up the commissioner, the chief commissioner for police, the chief constable here, and basically insist that he cancel all police leave till the person who did this is caught. Is that likely to happen? So in frustration, you blip open the door, you get in the car seat, and as you're about to drive away, you suddenly notice that there's a security camera, and it's pointing straight at your car. So you get back out of the driver's seat, you come back into the church and you find someone, you say, are those cameras, do they belong to the church? And they say, yeah, it's to look after the car parking spaces outside. You say, well, can I go and speak to the person in charge? They put you to the person in charge and you say, by any chance, do you record the video footage? They say, yes, you do. They say, and you say, please, may I have a copy? And they burn a copy onto DVD for you. You go home, you put it in your prayer, you press play. There's your car. And not only do you see the person who comes and keys your car, you recognize who they are. It's your next door neighbor. From the moment you moved in, they hated you for no reason whatsoever. They took an exception to you on day one. The removal van parked in the wrong place. They got very angry and upset. And since that day, they've made your life a living misery. They've never liked you. You see them walking by. They recognize your car. They come back. They check the number plate. They take out their key. They go up and down and they walk away spinning their keys. So imagine that the next day you invite your neighbor round for tea and cake. And as you give them the cup of tea and a homemade Victoria sponge, you say, oh, by the way, I have a little video clip I'd like to show you. And you press play. Now, how do you feel? Pretty good, right? Let's suppose you're the person who did the keying. You think you got away with it. Now the sucker is giving you cake and tea in his house. How could it get any better than this? And they hit play. Now how do you feel? Have you ever noticed when we get caught doing something wrong, we often feel angry about it? Have you ever noticed that? We don't like it. If I were to say there'll be a time when we'll all be judged and your first response is one of anger or resentment, what does that tell you about what side of the law you're on? If you have suffered injustice, you cry out for it. If you're on the wrong side of justice, you're trying to avoid it. God upholds justice, and he is loving. He is compassionate. He makes moral judgment. That's what makes his declaration of love over us so meaningful. He knows who you are. He's not fooled about that. And he's moved to the depth of his being to do something about it, and that's the cross. He's paid a price. He's taken the judgment for what we have failed to do and for what we have done wrong. And he's paid. Which is why we read about God's wrath. Now, the trouble with that word wrath is that most people, it conjures up the picture of some kind of highly irrational being who just lashes out. But that would be an incomplete and a wrong picture of what we mean when we talk about God's wrath. I started off before talking about keying cars, talking about sex slavery. What is the appropriate emotional response to people being bought and sold as slaves? Oh dear, that's not nice. Imagine you met someone in political power, a cabinet member of this country. You come and you present them with evidence of hundreds of thousands of women being bought and sold publicly in airports with no conviction, with no prosecution, and these people are being trafficked. Not for not very much money, just a few thousand pounds a head. What would be the appropriate emotional response? Well, hopefully the answer is disgust, anger, being genuinely appalled, horrified. God's wrath is the appropriate emotional response to wrongdoing, which dehumanizes us, makes us treat other people as less than human, and de-gods God, depersonalizes him, and takes us out of relationship with him. That is the appropriate response. Now, in light of this, what then would I say? Let me just read to you, just very briefly, a passage from Isaiah. This is from Isaiah 42. Behold, my servant whom I uphold, my elect one in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit on him, and he will bring forth justice to the Gentiles. He will not cry out or raise his voice, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, a smoking wick he will not put out. He will bring forth justice for truth. He will not fail nor be discouraged till he has established justice in the earth and in the coastlands, the nations, and in the coastlands they shall put their hope in his law. Isn't it interesting? The Bible sings of the prospect of God's justice one day, where rights will be put wrong. And it uses two pictures to talk about the effects of God's justice. One is bruised reeds will not be broken, and the other one is smoldering wicks will not be snuffed out. Let me just try to explain what's going on here. This passage, Isaiah 42, was written in a country called Iraq, okay? In southern Iraq, actually. Now, there was a program. I've read about this, and I've spoken about this many times, but I had never seen this before until I saw a program 1.5 years ago. I think it was on BBC, but I'm not a positive. Now, amongst all the terrible things that have happened in Iraq, one of the stories that a lot of people don't know is that southern Iraq was a huge wetland filled with these giant reeds. And when Saddam Hussein came to power, the tribes that occupied these wetlands were rebellious against him. And so even though this area was more rich in fish than any other part of the country and was filled with thousands of types of wild birds, he built canals and he drained the wetlands, okay, to turn them into desert, okay, chopped down all the reeds to make it easier to hunt these tribespeople out and extinguish them. After the Second Iraq War, while the American soldiers were still in place, a group of American army engineers basically reverse-engineered what Saddam Hussein had done. They shut off the canals and they flooded the wetlands again. And over the years, the reeds have come back, the fish have returned, and so have the birds. And it is stunningly beautiful. Now, these reeds are incredible things. Okay, you could take a baby reed, you can sharpen the end of it, and you can write with it. That's probably what the book of Isaiah was written with. Okay. You can weave them together and make a roof for your house. And if you know what you're doing, it's perfectly waterproof. As a matter of fact, you can weave them together and make a boat and go fishing, which is how the guys went out into the wetlands to go fishing. They are incredibly strong. There is one scene where you see the camera panning over the wetlands from quite a serious height. And then there's another camera. They show you a second camera angle filming the platform that this BBC camera with four or five people are standing on in order to film. And what they have done is they have taken these reeds, which have grown very tall, bent them over and tied them together using the greenery that grows out of the reeds. Does that make sense? So like a rope. And it is strong enough just to bend over, build a platform on which you could mount two cameras, put four adults up there, and it will not collapse. I mean, they are incredibly versatile, incredible things. However, bruised reeds are worthless. Okay? Once the reed has been crushed, if you apply enough external pressure and you crush the reed, well, you couldn't make a platform. When you stand on it, that reed would break and everything would collapse. Okay? You can't make a roof out of it. It's going to leak. You can't make a boat out of it. It's going to sink. So what do you do with bruised reeds? And the answer is, you chop them up, you boil water, and you have tea. Okay? They're hopeless. That's the first picture. The second picture is of a smoldering wick that will not be snuffed out. Now, if you're Jewish, you'll be aware of this. On the Sabbath, on Shabbat, you cannot work. You rest. Okay. Yes, that's right. It's forbidden. Yes, that's right. Yeah, you can't do anything. This guy who said you can't even take your car out. But not only that, you can't even snuff out a wick. Now, the kind of lamps they had, you'd have a wick in it, it would be made of lard, and the wick would burn through, and if it burned all the way through, it would hit the floor. Now, that's not a big problem, unless your house is built of reeds. In which case, actually, you now have a fire problem. So they would put a bowl of water underneath the lamps, does that make sense? So as the wick burnt through, if it did burn through on Shabbat, it would fall into the water and it would smoke. Now, to be doubly sure, most people would come and lick their fingers and put it out. But we are told that this justice, when it comes, will neither throw out the bruised reed nor will it snuff out the smoldering wick. What are the two pictures here? God's justice is such that as it comes and is executed in this world, those who have been crushed through external pressure and broken will not be discarded. They can be restored. Those who have exhausted their internal strength and burnt themselves out will not be snuffed out. They can be relit. The effect of God's justice when it comes and the effect of justice when it comes is it discards neither the broken nor the exhausted, whether you've been crushed from the outside or whether you've burnt up from within. And it's beautiful. A few weeks ago, I was actually speaking over in Memphis in the States, and I went to the American Civil Rights Museum. Now, I know a little bit about Martin Luther King and stuff like that, but I'd never quite seen anything like it in my whole life. As a matter of fact, the image that will not escape from me was one giant photograph they had during some very famous protests in Memphis, just before Martin Luther King was shot, where you saw countless men, black men, with the large square signs just tied around their neck with string. And on every piece of cardboard, it said, "I am a man." In other words, I'm a human being. Don't treat me like an object. Okay? I am a person. Treat me like a human being. Now, Martin Luther King was confined and arrested for being down in Birmingham, Alabama. And while he was in prison, he wrote a letter to the church. And the reason he wrote the letter to the church is that the church was complaining about his presence in Alabama, Birmingham, Alabama, campaigning for civil rights. So he wrote a long letter to them. I don't have time to read it all to you now. We're already 6 seconds over. I'm going to read you part of it. This is what he says. So this is a letter that was published against Martin Luther King publicly in the local newspaper by six church leaders, in which they said he was an outside agitator who was disturbing the peace and questioning his unwise and untimely arrival and the riots that had ensued. So this is what he wrote in prison, and then this letter was smuggled out of prison by his lawyer. If you want to read it online, it is an incredible letter. But this is how it starts. "My dear fellow clergyman, while confined here in the Birmingham City Jail, I came across your recent statement calling my present activities unwise and untimely. Seldom do I pause to answer criticism of my work and ideas. If I sought to answer all the criticisms that cross my desk, my secretaries would have little time for anything than others would have little time for anything else than such correspondence in the course of the day, and I would have no time for constructive work. But I feel that since you are men of genuine goodwill and that your criticisms are sincerely set forth, I want to try to answer your statements in what I hope will be a patient and reasonable term. I think I should indicate why I'm here, since you have been influenced by the view which argues against outsiders coming in. I have the honor of serving as president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, an organization operating in every southern state with headquarters in Atlanta, Georgia. We have some 85 affiliated organizations across the South, and one of them is the Alabama Christian Movement for Human Rights. Frequently, we share staff, educational, and financial resources with our affiliates. And several months ago, the affiliate here in Birmingham asked us to be on call to engage in non-violent direct action if it was deemed necessary. We consented, and when the hour came, we lived up to our promise. So I, along with members of my staff, am here because I was invited here. I'm here because I have organizational ties here. But more basically, I'm here in Birmingham because injustice is here. Just as the prophets of the 8th century BC left their villages and carried their Thus saith the Lord far beyond the boundaries of their hometowns, and just as the Apostle Paul left his village of Tarsus and carried the gospel of Jesus Christ to the far corners of the Greco-Roman world, so I am compelled to carry the gospel of freedom beyond my own hometown. Like Paul, I must constantly respond to the Macedonian call for aid. Moreover, I am cognizant of the interrelatedness of all communities and states. I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned about what happens in Birmingham. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." Now, he then goes on to say, "Look, you're complaining that I'm breaking the law." And then he goes on to write this. And remember, he's dictating this from memory. He has no access to a library. He says, "There are two types of laws, just and unjust. I would be the first to advocate obeying just law. One not only has a legal but a moral responsibility to obey just laws. Conversely, one has a moral responsibility to disobey unjust law. I would agree with St. Augustine that an unjust law is no law at all. Now, what is the difference between the two? How does one determine whether a law is just or unjust? A just law is a man-made code that squares with the moral law of God. An unjust law is a code that is out of harmony with that moral law. To put it in the terms of St. Thomas Aquinas, an unjust law is a human law that is not rooted in the eternal law. Of course, there is nothing new about this kind of civil disobedience. It was evident sublimely in the refusal of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, if you haven't read Daniel, you need to do so, to obey the laws of Nebuchadnezzar on the ground that a higher moral law was at stake. It was practiced superbly by the early Christians who were willing to face hungry lions and the excruciating pain of the chopping block rather than submit to the unjust laws of the Roman Empire. You speak of our activity in Birmingham as extreme. At first, I was rather disappointed that fellow clergymen would see my non-violent efforts as those of an extremist. I began thinking about the fact that I stand in the middle of two opposing forces in the Negro community. One is a force of complacency. The other is a force of bitterness and hatred, and it comes perilously close to advocating violence. It is expressed in the various black nationalist groups that are springing up across the nation, the largest and best known being Elijah Muhammad's Muslim movement. Nourished by frustration, this movement is made up of people who've lost faith in America, who've absolutely repudiated Christianity, and who have concluded that the white man is an incorrigible devil. I've tried to stand between these two forces, saying that we need to emulate neither the do-nothingism of the complacent nor the hatred and despair of the black nationalist. For there is a more excellent way of love and nonviolent protest. And I'm grateful to God that through the influence of the church, the way of nonviolence became an integral part of our struggle. If this philosophy had not emerged, by now the streets of the South would, I am convinced, be flowing with blood. But though I was initially disappointed at being categorized as an extremist, as I continued to think about the matter, I gradually gained a measure of satisfaction from the label. Was not Jesus an extremist for love? Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, pray for them which desperately reuse you and persecute you. Was not Amos an extremist for justice? Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Was not Paul an extremist for the Christian gospel? I bear in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus Christ. Was not Martin Luther an extremist? Here I stand, I cannot do otherwise, so help me God. So the question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists we will be. Will we be extremists for hate or for love? Will we be extremists for the preservation of justice or for the extension of justice? There was a time when the church was very powerful, when the early Christians rejoiced at being deemed worthy to suffer for what they believed in. In those days, the church was not merely a thermometer that recorded the ideas of the popular opinion. It was a thermostat that transformed the mores of society. Whenever the early Christians entered a town, the people in power became disturbed and immediately sought to convict Christians for being disturbers of the peace and outside agitators. But the Christians pressed on in the conviction that they were a colony of heaven, called to obey God rather than man. Small in number, they were big in commitment. They were too God-intoxicated to be astronomically intimidated. By their effort and example, they brought an end to such ancient evils as infanticide and gladiatorial contest. Things are different now. So often the contemporary church is weak, an ineffectual voice with an uncertain sound. So often it is an arch defender of the status quo. Far from being disturbed by the presence of the church, the power structure of the average community is consoled by the church's silent and often vocal sanction of things as they are. But the judgment of God is upon the church as never before. If today's church does not recapture the sacrificial spirit of the early church, it will lose its authenticity, forfeit the loyalty of millions, and be dismissed as an irrelevant social club with no meaning for the 20th century. Every day I meet young people whose disappointment with the church has turned into outright disgust. I hope the church as a whole will meet the challenge of this decisive hour. Never before have I written so long a letter. I'm afraid it is much too long to take your precious time. I can assure you that it would have been much shorter if I had been writing from the comfort of my desk. But what else can you do when you're alone in a jail cell other than write long letters, think long thoughts, and pray long prayers? If I have said anything in this letter that overstates the truth and indicates an unreasonable impatience, I beg you to forgive me. If I have said anything that understates the truth and indicates my having a patience that allows me to settle for anything less than brotherhood, I beg God to forgive me. I hope this letter finds you strong in the faith. I also hope that circumstances will soon make it possible for me to meet each one of you, not as an integrationist or civil rights leader, but as a fellow clergyman and Christian brother. The church needs to regain its compassionate moral voice. The church has never been more beautiful when it has been willing to lay down its life to protect those even with whom it disagrees and to campaign for justice regardless of the cost. So I have two responses and then we're going to throw this open for question just very briefly because I know we're way over. Number one, if you're sat here today as a Christian, my question is very simple. Have you accommodated the Christian gospel to your lifestyle? Are you living as Jesus Christ would have you live? Or have you just simply decided to accommodate what he has given to make your life more comfortable? You may find yourself being deeply disappointed with it and find it runs too shallow. If you're not a Christian and you're visiting here this evening, then my question to you would be this. Have you experienced a true and vibrant Christianity? Do you know what it is to truly know God, to be able to trust his character, and see within him the beauty where he both upholds justice, extends mercy, calls us to follow him humbly, to love justice and to love justice? Well, if you haven't, then I would commend him to you. Well, I've spoken for probably, I think, 10 minutes over, so my timekeeping is horrible. I'm sorry about that. The letter is about three times as long, in case you're wondering. Okay, please do get online and read the full text. But I think we have time for questions, is that right? Okay, right, so here we go. Oh gosh, if God is a God of justice, then why does the Bible say he is slow to anger? Surely if God was just, he would act faster, especially in such a war-torn and messed up world. Wow. Okay, good question. Do you have an easier question for me? No, okay. You know, it's very interesting. Some people think that the God of the Bible is impatient. For example, if you look at the far-reaching, which happens twice in the Old Testament times, where whole communities feel the effect of God's justice and judgment, people complain and say God's been entirely unreasonable. Whereas if you were to read the timeline, it was actually a 400-year time span between his command to them to turn away from their wicked ways and their failure to do so before he eventually came with a decisive measure of justice. So I can understand what you're saying. There are two things I'd like to say. Number one, if God were to deal with everybody that way, swiftly, every time he did something wrong, bam, believe me, you would not be doing very much every day. He would be intervening constantly in your life. Now, you may want to argue that's exactly what he should be doing. But I think God has something on his side that we don't. You see, we tend to get two things confused. We tend to think of this world as being a permanent fixture and our lives as a temporary presence within it. But the Bible actually reverses those two. According to the Bible, this world is temporary, and one day there'll be a new heaven and a new earth. We, however, will live forever. There's the promise of eternal life. So even though there are times where God does not act, and he does wait, and he does postpone, that postponement of justice at times is not because it is being deferred, but it will come. And what is more, if it is the case that we will live forever, and we have the opportunity of living forever with him, if you take the years of which we may suffer in this world and divide them by eternity, you're going to have a very, very small number, which is why Paul was able to talk about the brief and momentary injustice and pain that he suffered. And if you want to have a description of his brief and momentary pain and injustice, you can read it in the Bible, where he was beaten with the 40 lashes minus one 3 times, shipwrecked 3 times. He's known starvation, but danger from bandits, danger from the church, danger from outside the church, danger from false brothers, where he's known poverty, where he is known hunger, where he is known disease, and where he is known famine. I mean, it's all in there. It's the most incredible description, which, by the way, just in case you think it would be fun to spend time with the Apostle Paul, just bear that in mind the next time you think that you'd like to go and maybe travel with someone like him and hear the gospel preached in the way that he used to do it, because that was his normal experience. Starvation, prison, beatings. So there is a time when God does stay his hand. But don't mistake that divine patience with divine indifference. There will come a time when he will judge, and there is the possibility of an eternity with him. I don't know if you know the story of a man who was on a train walking up and down. He's got a screaming baby in his hands, and as he's got the baby's crying, he's going up and down saying, there, George. Don't worry. It's going to be okay, George. There, George. Don't worry. For 2.5 hours, walking up and down the train carriage with this baby just screaming, totally inconsolable. They get to the first major station and people start getting off, and as one of the person gets off, they just tap the man on the shoulder and they say, you're doing very well, George. I'm very impressed with your patience. And the man looks at them and says, what on earth are you talking about? He's George. I'm John. Hey, other way around. Never mind. You can tell I'm tired. But don't mistake divine patience for divine indifference. It's not the same thing. Go on, 3 more. 1 more. You said that God upholds justice. If this is the case, why do so many injustices occur? Most recently, only 2 of Stephen Lawrence's murderers being charged, especially since he came from a strong Christian family. Is this fair? Well, I guess that's very closely connected with the first question. The answer is no, it's not. If those men are indeed guilty, and only 2 of them have been convicted, then what has happened is a gross miscarriage of justice. There was a German philosopher by the name of Immanuel Kant. Now, you may not have read about him recently because he died a few hundred years ago. But Immanuel Kant is credited with having disproved the traditional proofs of God's existence. Now, having disproved, he felt, the traditional proofs of God's existence, he came up with one of his own. Now, some people think that the argument that Immanuel Kant came up with for God's existence was the most stupid argument ever given. Others feel it's one of the most profound. The people who think it's stupid say that Immanuel Kant came up with this argument because his housekeeper was upset with his disproving the traditional proofs of God's existence and had to come up with one because he didn't want to lose his housekeeper. Okay? I'm sure that's not true. But here's what he said. He said, how can we live in this world if it's the case that dictators and tyrants who rule with absolute injustice and cruelty die peaceably in their beds at ripe old ages and are never held account to their actions. He says it makes all convictions about morality a mockery. It makes all sense of judgment a morality. They've got away with it. He said if we're to be able to rescue meaning in this context, there must be a time where everybody will be held to account, where justice will be held, dished out, and where there will be a perfect judge who will administer such justice. And on that basis concluded that there was a God. So I agree with you. Without the promise of justice and the upholding of the law, then we're going to have faced despair and hope, hopelessness in a lot of situations. If there is justice, then we can live in hope. No one will get away with it. So another one? Or do you want to stop? You need to put up stop when you want me to stop up there. God is a loving God, so why has he predestined those who are going to go to heaven and those who are not? Surely he wants all to go to heaven. Okay, now we're straying slightly off our subject matter to talk about free will and predestination. Now, sadly, I've been predestined to answer this question in a very short period of time. And so, therefore, I'm going to have to compress my answer to you. Your question's making quite a lot of assumptions. So let me just give a few for you to think about. The Bible very famously states that it's God's will that no one should perish, but everyone should have eternal life. The Bible states, and Jesus Christ prayed, that all believers would be one as he and the Father is one. And you don't have to look very long at the church to realize that all believers are not one as he and the Father are one. So here's my question. If it's God's will that none should perish, but all should have eternal life, and yet hell is not empty, how is that possible? If Jesus Christ is able to pray for the unity of the church, and yet that prayer was ineffectual, just think about that. We are not one as he is one. We are divided. Not in Christ, but we are divided against each other, which is what Jesus seems to be praying for. How is that possible? So you're going to have to factor into this and into your question a response to this. Is it the case that God has made it possible for us to rebel against him or not? Now, if the answer to that is no, he hasn't, then we're going to have to conclude exactly what you've said there. But it seems to me that the Bible portrays a slightly more complex picture than is actually given there. Okay. So I agree with you. I think it is God's will that none should perish, but all should have eternal life. The Bible seems to be point blank sure about that. Now, there is one question, so let me just make your question a bit more complicated and then leave you with that complexity just to think about. Some people complain that I speak too quickly. Now, this is clearly a demonic attack against my ministry. What they're saying is that there's insufficient time to process the thought that I'm presenting. Right? Okay, more time is required to process what's being said. If it is the case that we struggle to think in a little bit of time, imagine what it would be like to try to think in the absence of time. Imagine I had a watch, and when I stopped my watch, time stopped. And whenever I stop my watch, and all time stops, what would you be able to think at that point? What would you be able to do at that point? What would you be able to feel at that point? And the answer is nothing. We can't think in the absence of time, let alone do it. We can't even imagine what it would be like to be able to do such a thing. However, we worship a God who is the author of space and time. We live in a space-time continuum, and I know that is true because I've seen Star Trek. So, that means before the Big Bang, before the origin of the universe, peace. Sorry. There was no space and there was no time. Now, the Greek of the New Testament is fascinating because four times it uses the phrase God doing something before time began. Now, it's fascinating because in Greek philosophy, there is no concept of time beginning. In the Greek philosophy of the time, indeed in the Roman philosophy, indeed in all philosophy, it was believed that the universe was eternally old. We're just here. The universe didn't have a beginning. Time and space just stretch back infinitely. We've always been here. There is no start. It was only the Jews and then later the Christians who believed that the universe had a beginning. And they were ridiculed by everybody for it. And in the New Testament, it uses the phrase quite clearly, you know, before time began, God did this. And then we now have this act of creation. In other words, we worship a being who can think, feel, and act in the absence of time. Now, this position was widely ridiculed up until the 1950s, when a rather crazy scientist suggested something called the Big Bang, suggested that actually maybe there was a beginning to space and time. One of the Nobel Prize-winning physicists in the UK violently opposed this heretical idea on the grounds that every Christian and Jew would start rejoicing if this were proved to be scientifically true, because it would give credence to the Bible. And therefore, for a while, it was actually quite hotly contested by many leading scientists, until eventually the cumulative evidence was so great that people were happy to concede that there was a beginning after all. But here's the point. We worship a being who exists outside of space and time. He sees all of space and time stretched out before him. What can you do that will take God by surprise? And the answer is very little. Nothing. Can you double bluff God? Could you order vanilla ice cream and then just as it's coming to the table say, no, I want chocolate. Now, these are some pretty profound thoughts. But if it is the case that God is the author of space and time, he sits outside of space and time and has created space and time as a continuum. The only means by which we could know him is if he's decided to reveal himself within it. And that's precisely what he's done. So now your question is asking me this question. How do we as beings who process through time and can only understand everything through the passage of time, relate to a God who can see everything without it? Now, that's a very hard question. If you can explain to me how that works, I can answer the other half of your question about how those two things interplay. But I've been predestined to finish there. Thank you very much. You've been very kind and gracious. And thank you for listening to me.